The folks on the other side are getting a chuckle out of that. It's like, ooh, wow. What a nice introduction there, Reggie. Or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, I'm trying to keep it light, folks. I don't want to go into the whole diatribe again and mention about the phone number yet again. But you know I'm going to do it anyway. 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org online. But at the very least, I'm trying to keep it light and positive. You know, I could go back into playing that Tibetan music that I did last summer that people apparently got a chuckle out of when I was doing that. But, okay, maybe I'm calling myself out a little ahead of time. So, anyway, stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up at 7 p.m.
In the area you are calling, your call cannot be completed at this time. Please try your call later. 078P.
We're sorry. The number you have reached, 99.5 WBAI, is now off the hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving. Now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. So Billy Bones was our best expect for worse. I hope that's understood. But Billy Bones!
Good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes.
And out in Skype land, we have Alex.
Good evening.
And we're honored to have our good friend Cory Doctorow with us as well.
Hello.
Welcome, Cory. For those who don't know, Cory is a prolific author, hacker, digital freedom fighter, overall troublemaker, and guess what? He's got another book coming out. He had another book. It's really amazing. It's called Red Team Blues. But the story is even bigger than just the book. We'll get to the book. We'll talk about the book in detail. But this has to do with bullies and with monopolies and with individuals fighting back against the system. You know, the things we talk about week after week here. In this particular case, what Cory has been trying to do is have his book published in audio format. You'd think that would be simple. You'd think that would be easy. You'd think that would be encouraged. But no, there's this entity called Audible, which is part of Amazon. And Audible apparently owns 90%, has a 90% dominance in the field. And they insist on having something called digital rights management, which basically means you're not free to do what you wish with the technology that you purchase. So if you were to buy something using Audible on Amazon, you would have to agree to their terms. You would have to have something that is crippled, that you cannot copy, that you cannot use on other devices. And if you ever disconnect from Amazon, you lose it entirely. And what Cory has done is taken them on. not for the first time either, because basically you put out a blog post saying Red Team Blues is another audiobook that Amazon won't sell. And so you started a Kickstarter with the humble goal of $15,000, and you are currently at $108,957. Congratulations on that. Corey, tell us, how did you first become aware of this this injustice that basically every author, I think, has to face at some point?
Well, look, you know, I was but a callow youth when an organization called the Electronic Frontier Foundation decided to represent a little magazine called 2600 after it published Jan Johansson's Code for Decrypting DVDs. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act had been passed in 1998, and Section 1201 of the DMCA provided for a $500,000 fine and a five-year prison sentence for removing a copyright restriction. And that rule did not have any exemption for fair use or for authorized use. So it meant that even though you could use DCSS, this program that 2600 published, to decrypt a DVD so that you could save it to your hard drive or down-res it so that you could run it on a little primitive computer of those days, you know, the kind that you pop the lid open and there was like a bird in there that went, eh, it's a living. All of those things were just out of scope. The court said that publishing this code was itself unlawful. And that was kind of the starter pistol for a kind of DRM land grab that has been going on ever since. You see, the law, the DMCA, is so broadly written that I, as the copyright proprietor, the person who wrote the book Red Team Blues, the person who paid Will Wheaton to narrate the book, and Gabriel DeQuire to direct it and paid for mastering and so on, I cannot give you a tool to unlock it from Amazon and take it to a non-Amazon platform or a non-Amazon app. Only Amazon can do that. And Amazon, when it has its suppliers over a barrel, does what you would expect any self-respecting monopolist to do. It squeezes them. In the case of Audible, the authors who work on ACX, which is Audible's self-serve platform for independent authors, discovered last year, or rather in 2020, that they were the subject of a $100 million wage theft, where Amazon was just lying about the royalty rate they were paying them. And this was only possible because Amazon was relatively certain that those authors weren't going to go anywhere, because if they did, they would have to bet that their audience was willing to just get rid of all their audiobooks and pay for them again on a new platform, because they couldn't authorize them to unlock the books that Amazon had sold. And Amazon mandatorily requires DRM. You can't choose not to sell with DRM. And from the very beginning, after Amazon bought Audible in an anti-competitive acquisition, I knew that this would eventually be bad for authors, that if Amazon was putting DRM on this book in order to protect us, then surely it would give us the right to decide whether we wanted that protection. I actually coined a thing I called Doctorow's Law, which is anytime someone puts a lock on something that belongs to you and won't give you the key, that lock is not to benefit you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that over time they would come to squeeze us, and here we are, and they're squeezing us. So for more than a decade now, I've paid readers like Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer and so on to read my work. Amber Benson from Buffy, and Will Wheaton. And I've released these audiobooks. The thing is that releasing them on the platforms that aren't Amazon doesn't get you very far. There are some really good audiobook stores like Libro.fm out there, but no one uses them. And for one thing, they're very clunky to use because of the app store tax. If you sell an audiobook through an app, you've got to pay either Apple or Google 30%, and the margin on an audiobook is 20%, so you would lose money on each of those. So the only way to get an audiobook on those platforms is you go to the Libro.fm website, you pay for the book there, then you switch back to the Libro.fm app and download it. And people just don't want to do it. And, you know, most people just haven't heard of anything except Audible. You know, on Apple, people buy with Apple Books, but Apple Books is just a front end for Audible. It's Audible's retail agent on the Apple platform, and it doesn't pay the App Store tax. So after a decade of doing this as kind of a symbolic gesture where I lost money on each of these books, but at least I had the audiobooks out there, I finally decided I was going to do something about it. So I kickstarted Attack Surface, the third Little Brother book, and you were kind enough to have me on when that was going on. That raised almost $270,000. And at that point, I realized that if I could demonstrate to other moderately well-known, moderately skilled, moderately internet-savvy authors that you could treat Amazon as damage and route around it, that we could build towards a critical mass of creators who would boycott Audible, even if it was just for the first 90 days, and get people habituated to buying their books elsewhere, especially with big front list titles. If we could do that with just, say, 100 top-selling authors for a couple of months, I think we could bring Amazon to heel. And so while these audiobook Kickstarters are very important to, you know, feeding my family, I'm a working author, and while my publisher, Macmillan, pays me well for those print rights, you know, these days audiobook is about half of your sales, so it's very important to, you know, bringing home the bacon. I also think that it's an important way of steering us towards a more pluralistic future where a format as important as audiobooks isn't controlled by one company whose primary goal is to make sure that its founder never wants for a penis-shaped rocket.
Yeah, well said. And this is something that seems to hold true with Amazon on a variety of fronts. We're also going through something similar. I'm not sure you heard about this, but basically Amazon decided to cut off magazine subscriptions on their platform. What this has done to small publishers has been horrific. They have simply decided that, nope, we're not going to do this anymore. After many of these publishers put a lot into Kindle versions of their publications, 2,600 included, so to be met with this, where either you're completely cut off or the amount that you do make is cut substantially, it's traumatic, and it seems to be something that's a theme, what you're going through right now, what every author is going through. As far as Audible though, what would happen if Amazon said, you know what, we're not going to have DRM anymore? Do you really think they would lose that much business?
I think that Amazon understands that if people if people are able to move around, that the abuses they can inflict on those people would be limited by the threshold at which they go somewhere else. So if you think about it, if you're in a situation where you can't afford to leave, the person who's got you in that situation can abuse you right up to the point where all the value you're getting out of that situation is outweighed by the abuse. And so for Amazon, lock-in is an asset that it can book. It can actually treat the fact that it knows that its audience is stuck where they are as something it can factor into its business plan. So, you know, they just announced that they're going to start putting ads in audiobooks.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know, if it were easy to leave, you could just take your audiobooks and you know, hive off to another platform, then that would be a non-starter, right? Someone in the boardroom would say, let's put ads in audiobooks, and someone else would say, are you crazy? People will start buying their books somewhere else. And once they start, they won't necessarily stop. I mean, one of the things that about this Audiblegate scandal where they were stealing $100 million from independent authors, that the way that they did that was they took people who are subscribing to Audible, so who pre-committed every month to buying an audiobook, which is a way of ensuring that they never take their business elsewhere, because most people don't listen to more than one book a month. And if you've already paid to listen to a book that month, you're gonna get the book from the place where you paid for it. What they did was they said to those people, hey, you know, we're such good-natured slobs. If for any reason after you get this book, for a whole year, no matter how many times you've listened to it, even if you've written it a positive review, you can return it. We won't ask you any questions about why you're dissatisfied with it. And we'll give you a credit to download another book. Right? This is an incredibly generous policy, and it raises the question, how can Amazon afford that generous policy? And the answer was, it took it out of the authors.
Uh-huh.
Every time you returned a book, they charged it back to the author. In fact, not just once. If you were the kind of author whose books got returned, they would say, oh, well, look, you might get returns in the future. We're going to take away one royalty for you for the book that was returned, and we're going to take away another one as a reserve against a return that might come in the future. Lest you empty out your royalty account, we have no way to gouge you for this. This was an act of extraordinary generosity that was borne by the authors that they had. They didn't tell the authors about this. They hid it from them. The only way that it became apparent is that they had an accounting glitch, and they did 3 weeks' worth of returns on one royalty statement. So instead of seeing that your sales were just declining and declining, you know, you used to be sold 50 copies a week, now it's 20, now it's 10, what they saw one day was that every Audible author, every ASX author had just sold a negative number of copies. And they all said, well, I don't understand. How can I sell minus 5 copies on your platform? And that was when people started to figure it out. One of the ACX authors is actually a forensic accountant who became a finance thriller writer named Colleen Cross. And she's the one who did all the shoe leather work on this. She figured out that everything about how they described their royalty schedule was a lie and that they were stealing from authors in this systematic way. And the reason they knew they could do that is they understood that if you went somewhere else, if you were disgusted by this $100 million wage theft and you went somewhere else, that your audience wouldn't be able to follow you, and that meant that you would have to start over. And they were just making a bet that if they had you locked in enough, they could do this terrible thing to you. It's not dissimilar. You know, remember when Frontier, which was like probably the second worst ISP in America after CenturyLink, do you remember when they went bankrupt during the pandemic? And we got to see their books, right? We got to see like their finances, and what we discovered is that if you lived in a territory where there was no competition, no cable modem, nothing else, that Frontier booked you as an asset because they understood that they could pay for less maintenance, do less infrastructure investment, and charge more, and you would still buy their service, right? If you can't go anywhere else, that's an asset. And that is a thing that Amazon is very keenly attuned to, is the long-term commercial value of depriving people of choice.
Amazing. And this seems to be a theme. I've noticed over the years that writers, authors, they tend to always be on the short end of the stick, whether it's through distributors, whether it's through bookstores, whether it's through companies like Amazon. Why do you think the author is always the victim? I mean, they're the source.
Well, they're the, on the one hand, they're the easiest ones to abuse. And on the other hand, you know, we've been told as authors, you know, and when I was a baby writer, I heard this all the time, that the best tool that we have to defend our interests is copyright, which is foundationally, it's an individual bargaining right, right? It's the right for you, you know, a plucky LLC to go up to one of these big multinational companies and say, all right, guys, you're a business, I'm a business, let's do business here. And we see how that works out over and over again. As an individual, you have very little negotiating leverage. You know, I wrote a book with my colleague Rebecca Giblin, who's an Australian copyright scholar, called Choke Point Capitalism, that came out last autumn. And it investigates the question, how is it that for 40 years we've made copyright last longer? We've made it cover more kinds of works. We've created higher statutory penalties. We've made it easier to secure those penalties in the case of an infringement. We've made the entertainment industry itself larger and more profitable than it's ever been. And the share of income going to the creative workers has declined, both in real terms and proportionally. And the answer is that when there's 5 publishers, 4 studios, 3 record labels, 2 giant ad tech companies and 2 app companies, one of those is the same company, and one company that controls all the audiobooks and ebooks, that giving a creator more copyright, it's like giving your bully kid extra lunch money. There isn't an amount of lunch money you can give your kid that will get them lunch. You're just giving money to the bullies. And eventually they might even use some of that money to run an international campaign saying, think of America's hungry school children, give them more lunch money. Still not going to get those kids fed. And so what you need are structural interventions. So in this case, you know, we need things like fair contracting terms. And the European Union and the Digital Single Markets Directive in 2019, they passed a transparency rule that would require Amazon to disclose to every creative worker who they owed a royalty to exactly how they calculated that royalty, right? Well, you know, one of the reasons they got away with this is because they – you know, the people didn't know why their sales were going down. We could modify or repeal the Digital Millennium Copyright Act so that bypassing DRM for a lawful purpose or with the author of the rights holder whose work has been locked up with DRM is presumptively lawful, so that you couldn't – you know, this is the crazy thing, right? If you pirate my audiobook, you face a $150,000 fine. If I give you a tool – to take the audiobook that I hold the copyright to and take you take it off of Amazon, Amazon can put me in prison for 5 years. Right? So we could just modify the law so that actual copyright infringement was the thing that copyright defended us against, not felony contempt of business model, where your only crime is doing something that makes Amazon shareholders sad.
Do you think that is a realistic possibility that Amazon would go after you if you told someone how to pirate your own book?
Gave them a tool?
Yeah.
Yeah, if I started a business that said, look, here's your tool to you know, one click and you're not an Amazon customer anymore, I would be very certain they would. And what I'm very, very certain of is that there isn't a venture capitalist or bank manager who give me a loan or some startup capital to start that business. That is a hell of a business risk. And there's just no way that I'm gonna that you know anyone's gonna fund that business or start that business. You know, it's Larry Lessig, who you know helped start Creative Commons and is quite a leading light in tech policy circles. He says the world is regulated by code and markets and norms and laws. That it's this mix of like what's legal, what's possible, what's profitable, and what's socially acceptable. And you know, something's illegal, it's very rarely profitable unless you're willing to become a career criminal. Right? Like that is, and so the unlawfulness of this makes it unprofitable as well, which means that we don't see what, you know, a good capitalist would want to see, which is a competitor coming in and offering authors a better shake. You know, when I started as a baby writer, there were 30 publishers in New York. Today there's 5, right? And you know, the fact that writers get lower advances on average and do worse on average is strongly related to that. You know, when Penguin Random House tried to buy Simon & Schuster, Stephen King gave testimony, and he said, Penguin Random House, Simon & Schuster say that they'll still bid against each other for my books when I write a new book. He said, you got to have your head examined if you think that's true. That's like saying my wife and I are going to bid against each other on the house we both plan on living in. There's no way that's true. It insults our intelligence to say that it's true. Any auction that has fewer bidders has a lower closing price. Anyone's ever bought anything on eBay knows that in their bones. And so, you know, this is just another expression of what happens when you stop enforcing antitrust law, as we did 40 years ago, and as we stopped doing 2 years ago when Joe Biden appointed Lina Khan, who's amazing, and Jonathan Cantor to respectively run the FTC and the Department of Justice antitrust division. When you stop enforcing antitrust law, you get monopolies. It's like when you stop putting out rat traps, you get rats. You know, people have been looking around at our monopolized markets for the last 20 years as they became increasingly concentrated and the web turned into, you know, 5 giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other 4. And they were like, oh, the great forces of history are so mysterious. How did we get here? And the answer is we used to have rat traps. And we didn't have rats. We stopped putting out rat traps, and now we're overrun by them. We know exactly how that happened.
Go ahead, Alex.
You know, speaking of these monopolies and how to break them, and this question that you raised, Emmanuel, of, you know, do you really think that somebody like Amazon would go after you if you developed a business around unlocking things? I mean, you got to go right back to, you know, how we started the show. I think the answer to that is unequivocally a yes. You know, we started the show with Corey talking about DCSS. Remember, you were sued not for creating a business around something, but for publishing code on your site and in a magazine that would allow somebody to just unlock a DVD, to crack a basically an encryption system that was, as I understand it, a monument to stupidity back then. And one of the things that's fascinating, I just want to mention this as an aside, is if you recall, and God, I can't believe it was like 23 years ago now, but the judge who presided over the DCSS case, the 2600 versus MPAA case, was Lewis Kaplan. And do you know what case he is presiding over right now? Well, you're on mute, Corey.
Yeah, Corey, you're muted.
Sorry, you mentioned this the last time I was on. You got to tell them. This is mind-blowing.
Well, actually, I think he's overseeing the SBF trial now.
Oh, I didn't realize that. It was I was thinking Stephen Donziger, but yes, exactly. SBF too.
Wow.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh, the Southern District of New York is a hell of a place.
I can't believe he's still on the bench. You know, no disrespect, but wow, he seemed old then.
Yeah.
You were just young then, Manny.
That's true. Yeah, he must be getting up there, Lewis Kaplan. He really must. But you know, judges in the Southern District tend to have a lot of longevity, for better or for worse. There was a judge, Judge Leisure, who you know, he took about like 11 months to get back to me once on a motion to dismiss, but he came back with like a 93-page opinion. You know, and I think he was 92 years old or something at the time. So you know, it was they're impressive.
That's something.
Yeah.
So now, Corey, this is the third time you've done this, right?
Yeah.
And have things changed? Has the reaction gotten stronger? Or has the resistance gotten more?
Amazon has definitely the pall has gone off of it, right? I think, you know, so today, like, Amazon's got this $31 billion a year advertising business that they, you know, whenever anyone talks about monopoly in ad tech, someone's like, oh, well, wait, isn't Amazon now competing in that space? There's the Amazon ad marketplace. Except Amazon's ads aren't like the other ads. I mean, there's problems with the other ads too, but what Amazon's ads are is they're payola. When you search on Amazon, the first five screens are 50% ads. The first screen is all ads, and those ads are sellers bidding against each other to match your query, even if they're not what you searched for. And the $31 billion that Amazon transfers from sellers to itself to stick stuff in front of you that you explicitly didn't ask to see instead of the thing you did ask to see is something that raises the price of all the goods on Amazon. Amazon has this thing called the most favored nation status deal, which requires each of its sellers to promise not to allow their goods to be sold more cheaply anywhere else, even direct from the manufacturer, which means that if you're paying $31 billion a year in aggregate to Amazon, you've raised your prices. In fact, the total junk fee burden on Amazon sellers is over 50% now. So the on average, an Amazon marketplace sale accounts more than 50% of the money that you spend goes to Amazon and not the seller. The way that they make that up is they raise their prices, but they raise them everywhere because of most favored nation. And that means that the prices at Target are higher because of Amazon's junk fees. They're higher at Walmart and they're higher at your corner, bodega. This is why the Attorney General of DC is suing Amazon. So I think people are starting to clock that the Amazon story of low prices and great quality and lots of convenience is really thin. And that's, you know, even if you don't care about people dying of heat stroke in the warehouses or peeing in bottles in the vans, there are lots of people who are very frustrated and angry with Amazon for very, very, very good reasons. And then on top of that, you have just a string of kind of horror stories about the way that they treat authors, about the way that they treat cities. You know, after that Hunger Games deal about where their headquarters would be, they promised to stick one, you know, right outside the Beltway there. They wrung all kinds of concessions and subsidies out of the local city, and then they just rugged them. They just said, "Hey, you know, we changed our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the subsidies. You know, we'll see you later." So I think that like, this is a moment in which people are just tired of big tech. I think the story that big tech would make our lives better has been comprehensively debunked.
Yeah.
And so this is our moment to seize.
Like, where is small tech being lauded? I fully am with that sentiment.
Yeah. I think the place it's being lauded is in Mastodon. It's in the Fediverse. As the Fediverse grows, I think small tech is having its moment.
Yeah, no, we've certainly seen that with Elon Musk losing his damn mind and Twitter going down the tubes. Mastodon has definitely been blossoming. Hopefully it becomes more accepted by people who aren't so technical. It'll become easier to use, faster, we'll find other solutions. What you say about the cities, though, that really resonates because we dodged a bullet here in New York. You know, AOC deserves so much credit for fighting that, being literally the only politician fighting it. And had Amazon gone through with their plans for Brooklyn and Queens, I dare say it would have been a catastrophe. We see Amazon buildings throughout the island, Long Island, that are obviously Amazon buildings. They have that how would you describe it, Kyle?
Well, the fulfillment centers are like white, gray, and blue, but the supermarkets that they're opening just basically are popping up in mixed use retail, and it's like a green, like a chartreuse and black stripe over the entrance.
And there are these buildings that they've just abandoned. They're not, they've changed their minds, and they're just taking up space. So, yeah, they have you over a barrel, and then they decide to do something else, and you have no options.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who are such, you know, ethical and forthright folks that even if they had you at their mercy, they would exercise that power wisely. But I think that Amazon has shown itself institutionally and individually in the character of its managers to not be one of those companies. Amazon is not a company that it ever hesitates to use its advantage. You know, one of the things that we write about in Chokepoint Capitalism is that Amazon had a program after it reached a critical mass with publishing where it was really controlling the future of publishers and, you know, was tired of subsidizing their products because, you know, the platform lifecycle is first, they're very good to their end users. And they do things like subsidize the products that you're buying. Amazon was like losing money on every sale so that your books were cheaper. And they decided that they were tired of that. And so they wanted to get more money. And so they said, we're going to go to each of the small publishers, the independent publishers that we represent here. And we are going to ask them for a discount that we know that they can't afford, an unsustainable discount that will eventually cause their businesses to collapse. And we're going to see how much of that discount we can get out of them just as a, like to see, you know, how far we can go, right? What kind of discount we can get. And that program was called Operation Gazelle. And the reason it was called that is that the project managers who were doing the negotiation were exhorted to think of themselves as cheetahs bringing down the sickly gazelles in the herd.
Oh, my God.
The only part of that program that Amazon's lawyers objected to was the name. The conduct itself was fine with them.
I can sort of see their point because it just makes them look so bad.
It really does, absolutely. But, you know, this is the kind of business it is, right? You know, I'm always skeptical of people who want to like ascribe a character to a company. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to say, oh, Fox is the bad boys and Fox movies and Disney are the squeaky clean ones. And, you know, they're such different characters, such different corporate persons. And, you know, like Bob Iger and Rupert Murdoch were able to like, you know, consolidate a merger without any of this seeming to bother them at all. And so, you know, like either we're asked to believe that, you know, they're star-crossed lovers like the Montagues and the Capulets, or, you know, the difference between them was just always a minuscule and unimportant difference in that they really had much more in common, like, you know, mutual desire never to pay taxes or allow unions or, you know, bear any corporate responsibility for their actions. And then everything else was just like a kind of difference at the margin that barely mattered at all. It didn't even register as a difference that made a distinction. I really think that, like, even against that, it's pretty clear how Amazon thinks of its business culture, right? They think of themselves as an apex predator, and they think of their chances for future success as being determined by whether they can abuse their suppliers in ways that their suppliers can't resist.
Corey, have you considered writing a book about Amazon and then offering it on Amazon?
Well, you know what we did do is the chapter about how Audible rips off authors in Chokepoint Capitalism is the only chapter of the book available on Audible, and we made it an Audible exclusive.
Oh, wow.
And so if you go to Audible and you look up Chokepoint Capitalism, you will find just that one chapter. And you know what? I encourage you to return it for a full refund if you buy it. Buy it, listen to it, return it for the full refund. This is one that you can do that guilt-free with. But Brad Stone's pair of books about Amazon are pretty magisterial as these things go. The literature doesn't need another book that I would write. I would just be quoting Brad at that point. So yeah, I don't think it needs my intervention. There's already a good literature revolving. And you know, besides that, if you want a really definitive paper on Amazon, it's Lena Kahn's paper when she was a third year law student. She wrote a paper called Amazon's Antitrust Paradox that was a rebuttal to Robert Bork, the judge and scholar who created the Reagan ideology of getting rid of antitrust law with a book called The Antitrust Paradox, and who more than anyone else is responsible for the lack of antitrust enforcement over the last 40 years. And she wrote this paper as a third year law student to rebut his book. And it was such a persuasive and important paper that it upended the way that people think about antitrust. And today, 6 years later, she's going into her second year as the youngest ever chairperson of the Federal Trade Commission, which is to say the most powerful consumer welfare regulator in the world. She is a remarkable person.
That gives me hope. That gives me a lot of hope. I'd like to focus on the book a little bit because it's an accomplishment. Red Team Blues comes out later this month. I'd like to play a clip from the audiobook read by Will Wheaton. Great choice, by the way. And this actually comes from your podcast, so it's behind the scenes. So we'll hear a little bit of the prep and get into the beginning of the book with a very moving tribute. So
and you'll hear the director Gabrielle Dequeer giving Will his direction. Obviously, that won't be in the final audiobook here.
All right, here's an excerpt from Red Team Blues.
It is it's perfect. Nope, it's great. Yeah. Back up here we go. Ready?
Okay, we're rolling.
For Dan Kaminsky, 1979 to 2021. Hacker, pen tester, mensch. Rest in peace, Dan. One evening, I got a wild hair and drove all night from San Diego to Menlo Park. Why Menlo Park? It had both a triple Michelin star place and a dear old friend, both within spitting distance of the Walmart parking lot, where I could park the unsalted hash, leaving me free to drink as much as I cared to, and still be able to walk home and crawl into bed. I'd done a job that turned out better than I'd expected, well enough that I was set for the year if I lived carefully. I didn't want to live carefully. The age for that was long past. I wanted to live it up. There'd be more work. I wanted to celebrate. Truth be told, I also didn't want to contemplate the possibility that at the age of 67, the new work might stop coming in. Silicon Valley hates old people, but that was okay because I hated Silicon Valley. Professionally, that is. Getting close to Bakersfield, I pulled the unsalted hash into a rest stop to stretch my legs and check my phone. After a putter around the picnic tables and vending machine, I walked the perimeter of my foolish and ungainly and luxurious tour bus, checking the tires and making sure the cargo compartments were dogged and locked. I climbed back in, checked my sludge levels, and decided they were low enough that I could use my own toilet. Then, finally, having forced myself to wait, sat on one of the buttery leather chairs and checked my messages. That's how I learned that Danny Laser was looking for me. He was working the usual channels, DMs from people who I tended to check in with when I was looking for work, and it put a shine on my evening because, 67 or no, there was always work for someone with my skill set. Danny Laser had a problem with his trustless coin keys, which relied on the best protective cryptographic secrets in the world, nominally. So I messaged him. One rest stop later, just past Gilroy, I got his reply. He was eager to see me. Would I call on him at his home in Palo Alto? My pathetic little ego swelled up at his eagerness. I told him I had a big dinner planned the next night, but I'd see him the morning after. Truth be told, putting off a man as important as Danny Laser, even for 24 hours, made me feel more important still. I could tell from his reply that the delay chafed at him. I felt petty, but not so much so that I canceled my dinner. My dear old friend was a lively sort, and it was possible we'd walk from the restaurant to her place for an hour or three before I returned to the Walmart parking lot. Dinner didn't disappoint, and neither did the fun and games afterward. It was a very nice capstone to a very successful job, and a very good prelude to another job for one of the nicest rich men, or richest nice men, in Silicon Valley. Danny was old Silicon Valley, a guy who started his own UUCP host so he could help distribute the alt hierarchy, and once helped Tim May bring a load of unlicensed firearms across state lines from a Nevada gun show. He'd lived like a monk for decades, writing cryptographic code and fighting with the NSA over it, and had mortgaged his parents' house back east to keep himself and a couple of programmers in business in a tiny office for a decade, while he and Galit lived in a 30-foot motorhome that needed engine tuning once a month just so it could trundle from one parking space to the next. It was a bet that there would come a day when the internet's innocence would end and people would want privacy from each other and their governments, and he kept doubling down on that bet through every boom and bust, living on ramen and open cereal boxes from the used food store, refusing to part with any equity except to promising hackers who'd join him. And then the bet paid off, and he became Daniel Moses Laser, with a 75% stake in KeyPairs LLC, whose crypto libraries and workflow tools were the much ballyhooed picks and shovels of the next internet revolution. KeyPairs wasn't the first unicorn in Silicon Valley, but it was the first one that never took a dime in venture capital, and whose sole angels were Danny's parents back in Jersey, to whom Danny sent at least $100 million before they made him stop, insisting that they had nothing more they wanted in this world. Galit picked out a big place in Twin Peaks that you could see Alcatraz from on a clear day, gutted it to the foundation slab, bare studs, and ceiling joists, completely rebuilt it while being mindful of both Danny's specification for networking receptacles throughout and Galit's encyclopedic knowledge of the arts and crafts movement. One day, as she was bringing out some Mendocino Grig and a cheese board for the two of them to enjoy from their half-built porch, she gasped, complained of pain in both arms, then her chest, and then she collapsed and was dead before the ambulance arrived.
All right, we're going to stop it on that cheerful note there. The opening words to Cory Doctorow's Red Teen Blues, as read by Will Wheaton. We are here with Cory Doctorow on Off the Hook here on WBAI. Cory, I am intrigued. I understand this is the beginning. This is actually part of a trilogy.
It's not even a trilogy. It's like a series of unknown duration. So this is Marty Hensch's last adventures, you know, 67-year-old hard-charging forensic accountant who's ready to retire and has this one last job. And after I wrote it, so I wrote it in like 6 weeks flat. I just like, blam, came right out of my fingertips.
In a white-hot fury. A white-hot fury, yeah. You described it.
Yeah, the last time I wrote a book this fast, it was Little Brother. So I had a feeling I had something special. You know, I gave it to my wife who, like, I should note here that I write when I'm anxious. So I have 7 books in production right now. My wife can't read them all. She's got other stuff to do. So it is often the case that I write a book and she kind of, you know, pokes at it over the course of weeks or whatever. But she always glances at it when I finish it. And so I gave it to her. I rolled over at 2:30 in the morning. She was sitting up in bed with her phone, and I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I just had to find out how it ended." And then my editor emailed me the next morning, and it was just like 4 lines.
Now, remember, we're on the radio, and there's certain words you can't say.
Yeah, he emailed me, "That was an effing ride. Wow." And bought 3 of them. And the problem was that how do you write a sequel to the final adventure of a detective? And what I realized was that so long as they went backwards in time, I could write any number of adventures for this detective. And moreover, that I wouldn't have to worry about continuity because I could retcon everything as I went. I could do the continuity backwards. I could backshadow instead of foreshadowing.
You've hacked time. You have hacked time.
Indeed. So there's 3 of these. They're all written. Only this one finished through its editorial process, but they're all coming out over the next 18 months or so. And the next one is about prison tech and about, the use of, digital rights management for, email, music and books in prisons and in private prisons especially. And then the final one, or the third one, which may or may not be the final one, is his first adventure, and it's set in the heroic era of the PC in the 1980s, and it tells how he drops out of MIT, he falls in love with spreadsheets, becomes a CPA, goes out west, and his first job is working for one of these weird early PC companies called the Three Wise Men, that's run by a Mormon bishop, a Catholic priest, and an Orthodox rabbi. And it turns out that it's an affinity scam, that they use multi-level marketing to prey on their parishioners. And he quickly comes to understand that he's working for the wrong people, that he has been tasked with hunting down and ruining the business of three rogue employees. One is a Orthodox woman who's come out as queer. One is a nun who's joined the Marxist liberation theologists in Central America. And one is a LDS woman who's left the faith because they wouldn't support the Equal Rights Amendment. And that these three rogue employees are actually jailbreaking these computers. They're giving people the tools they need to bring their spreadsheets out of the lockdown environment of the Three Wise Men computer. They're giving them tools to use standard floppy disks in the floppy drives because they use proprietary floppies. And they've even re-sprocketed their printers, so you need a special kind of fanfold paper. And they're selling a sprocket replacement kit that de-re-sprockets your printer, so you can just use commodity fanfold paper. And it turns into a kind of gang war over proprietary PCs set in the early 80s. Jello Biafra's got a cameo. It's all San Francisco in the heyday of punk and queer liberation. It's got lots of callbacks to Armistead Maupin and the Tales of the City. It's really fun.
Wow, that is awesome. Really incredible. And you know, I found a review actually of copies of the book. The reviewer says, "I'm not that knowledgeable about crypto or tech jargon, but it's not really necessary to follow the story. What surprised and pleased me the most was the subversion of the usual detective novel formula. You think you're going to be following one mystery, but that's quickly wrapped up in the first third of the book, and that's when it really takes off."
That's right. That's right. Yeah, Marty, spoiler, Marty does find the keys, but that's just the beginning. It turns out the people who stole the keys and the people who would prefer that they'd stolen the keys and a bunch of rogue three-letter agencies are all in on the game. You know, this is an anti-finance thriller. It's a book about how speculation and finance took the dream of tech and turned it into just another grift. And it's about someone looking back at the kind of the last days of the bloom of tech, who believed in its promise and confronting what became of it. It's a melancholic novel, but also one that is quite angry, and one that is, I think, ultimately a call to action for seizing the means of computation, for bringing tech back to its users, to steal our revolution back.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially that investigative angle, because it employs so much technique and skill that you might find hackers totally in tune with and fascinated by, even though you're in this world of finance, which seems absurd, but also the character and not familiar, really, like, you know, boardrooms or sort of a cushy a world that they kind of go between and so forth, but also the chasm that crypto and digital finance has in characters involved, like the first character that's being described as being kind of an outsider, a leader in one of these entities, emerging startups and so forth. That whole culture itself, though foreign, that distinction in some of the characters you're introducing us to really, I think, pulls in a little bit from that with little attributes that remind us so much of hacking and I think our audience can identify with.
Oh, sure. And, you know, I think crypto is one of these the most divisive issues in the world of cryptography. You know, this is a group of people, at least outside of government service, who were forged together by the crypto bans and the crypto wars of the 90s when crypto was classed as a munition and the NSA didn't want any civilian to have access to it. And in general, there's, I think, a lot of camaraderie among cryptographers. And cryptocurrency, you know, it does some interesting practical stuff with things that cryptographers have long dealt with merely as theory. And I think at first a lot of cryptographers were very enthusiastic about it as a puzzle, if nothing else. And, you know, the more speculative it got, the harder it became to sort of maintain that stance. And today there's a real division. And, you know, there's still people who are doing things with crypto that I think of as interesting. I mean, you know, Chelsea Manning is working for a crypto firm and they're doing stuff with identity and, you know, trying to figure out things like secure enclaves as a way of doing crypto without having to, like, burn whole forests down and so on. I saw her a little while ago at South by Southwest. She was very excited to learn that I'd written a novel about secure enclaves. It's not a subject that many people are interested in, but I think it is an intrinsically very fascinating interest.
Corey, we're in our last minute, so I want to give you the opportunity both to say something to new writers that hopefully might inspire them in this difficult time to actually put something out that will get read by people, and give us all kinds of contact info. Of course, you're welcome to join us on YouTube at 8 o'clock if you're able to. But if you could please share that information,
sure.
That would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first things first, I'd be a bad promoter if I didn't tell you that if you go to redteamblues.com, you'll be sent to the Kickstarter. That's just for starters. In terms of advice for young writers, the one piece, it's very quotidian, but the one piece of advice that I wish I'd taken more seriously when I was a baby writer is to write every day, because something that you do every day becomes a habit, and habits are things that you get for free. And I think the secret of writing every day is to understand that although there are days when you'll feel like you're writing trash, and there are days when you feel like you're writing brilliantly, and although when you go back and look over your work, some of it will be trash and some of it will be brilliant, that how you feel about it when you're writing it is not related to the quality of the work. Then how you feel about it has more to do with whether you're fighting with your partner, getting enough sleep, have low blood sugar, all of those exogenous factors. And that the only way to overcome writer's block is to really recognize that on those days when it feels like every word is unworthy and you shouldn't even try, that you have no idea. You might be writing the best work of your life. And just like if you've ever been in one of those VR experiences where you have to walk across a plank while wearing a VR headset that makes it look like you're, you know, walking out over the Empire State Building observation deck, and you know intellectually that you're just standing on the carpet, but your brain is telling you that you're standing over a 150-foot drop. You just have to make yourself do it. In the same way, there's some part of you telling you that these words are unworthy and you shouldn't write them, you have to feel the feeling and do it anyway.
Awesome. Well, I hope you keep doing it, and thank you for all that you've done and all you continue to do. And we will be back in about 7 minutes on YouTube. Write to us, oth@2600.com. On YouTube, it's channel 2600, or follow the link that's right now being displayed on the main 2600.com page. We'll be back again next week at 7 p.m. on WBAI, and please support WBAI. Keep this radio station going. Give to WBAI.org is the website. 212-209-2950 is the phone number.
And a big shout out to the whole engineering crew at WBAI headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Please check out WBAI.org. Find out how you can donate and contribute.
Good night.
Good night.